My name is David Wee. I'm an English professor at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. And there I teach a course on baseball and American values. And what we'll do tonight is, in part, is to give you a little sense of what we do in a course like that, but mainly get at questions about this game that so many of us love so well. It's always embarrassing for my students when they go home at Christmas time and mom and dad say, well, what are you going to study during January term? And they say, baseball. And mom and dad say, yeah, right. And it is hard to explain, hard for them to explain until, of course, they've finished the course. And then they're eloquent about explaining why this is important. Yeah. I was one of those, and some of you here may be similar, who grew up thinking that the last two words of the national anthem were play ball. And baseball, for me as a child, as well as for many others, has been a very important thing. How many people here pay attention to baseball to some degree? Okay. And how many do not? Which is fine. That's fine. I should report that in my class, it's hard to do the course description in order to encourage a diverse group, because I want to have non-believers in the class as well as and I do have every year people who have taken the course because they want to figure out, you know, why their boyfriend cares so much about baseball, or who simply don't have much of an interest, but they know it's a big deal for some people, so they want to learn more about it. And usually the enrollment is about 2/3 men and 1/3 women, but every year but one, I've been teaching a course for 20 years, every year but one, the most knowledgeable baseball person in the whole class was a woman. It's not just a men's deal. And Aunt Minda, at 85, knew more about baseball and the Twins than most young men that haven't had as much history as Aunt Minda had to live with. So I'm going to tell you a little bit. I put some texts up here and some topics just to let you know what the course is like. But the first thing I do every day for class is to have batting practice. It's important at every game for the players to get loosened up and warmed up, and it's true in a college classroom as well. So we start out with a few trivia questions just to wait for the latecomers to arrive.
So I'll
can I hit the ball out?
I'll ask you a few just for fun. And now the interesting thing about baseball trivia is that in most cases, in my mind, it doesn't matter if you know what the answer is. The important and fascinating thing is that such a thing could have happened, as the question asks, and all these things have happened. One of my favorites is, what Major League Baseball player, in his first time at bat in the major leagues, hit a home run, and then in 20 more years in the major leagues, he never hit another home run? This actually happened. Anybody know or guess? It was Hoyt Wilhelm. He was a knuckleball pitcher for the White Sox, and hit a home run his first time at bat. And there are only 50 or 60 players in the whole history of baseball who've done that. And it's, you know, they go into the record books. But he went for 20 years and never hit another. And there's another guy, I can't remember his name right now, I only learned this recently, who hit a home run on his first time at bat in the major leagues and on his last time at bat in the major leagues. And he did hit some others in between, but to do that on your first and last at-bats is really rare. What Major League Baseball player hit into an all-Cuban triple play. Well, only one that we know of, and this was Whitey Herzog, who has been a well-known manager. But when he was playing for, I think it was the Kansas City Athletics at that time, or the Royals, he hit into a, he was at bat, and there were a couple runners on base, and he hit a ball, and it went from to Camilo Pascual to, oh God, sometimes Sandy Valdespino to somebody else. There were, I've forgotten the names, but all three of them were players who were born in Cuba. And you know, this is meaningless but interesting. And what player hit into a triple play? You know, this is the most ignominious thing you can do in baseball, other than striking out five times in one game. But to make three outs in one time at bat. Hit into a triple play in his last time at bat in the major leagues. It had to be a Met. And it was Joe Pignatano, catcher for the Mets, did that. But one of the most interesting and fairly significant trivia question is this one. This will be the last one. What major league pitcher has the best lifetime pitching record against the New York Yankees? Okay, hang on a second then. What pitcher, you know, had the best pitching record against the Yankees? And you figure it had to be somebody who wasn't pitching during the dynasty years of the Yankees.
Was it Bob Feller?
It wasn't Bob Feller, because he had the misfortune of pitching, you know, during those years when the Yankees, you know, were winning all the time. Okay, Marvin, tell us the answer.
Babe Ruth.
Babe Ruth had the best pitching record of anybody ever against the Yankees. He started his career with the Boston Red Sox. Yeah. And he was the best pitcher in baseball in his time. And the Yankees always suffered. And of course, when Boston sold him to the Yankees after the 1919 series, and Boston has not done well since. It's referred to as the curse of the Bambino, Boston has never recovered from that. Well, here on the board, and forgive me if you can't read these, but you could look at them later on, I put some of the topics, the subtopics that with which we discuss baseball in a college course. Here are some of the textbooks that I use and some of the very good American novels. And then here are some numbers. We might as well do the numbers. Now, some of you know what every one of these numbers means, and others don't know what any of them mean, which is fine. It's not to be embarrassed. This is part of baseball history, and some people have such an intense interest in the game that certain numbers just get enmeshed in our minds. 2,130.
Gehrig streak.
That's the, explain a little further for people.
Lou Gehrig's consecutive game streak that Cal Ripken broke.
Okay. Lou Gehrig played in 2,130 consecutive games, and people thought this would never be broken. His nickname because of this? Lou Gehrig's nickname?
The Iron Horse.
You can't imagine how delighted I was when one time I was assigned a pin. 2130 was my personal identification number.
And I meant something.
Uh, 300.
Sandy Gray.
Yeah, this is sort of the any player who bats above 300, that's three hits out of every 10 times at bat.
Now, that's also a perfect game if you pitch a 16-pound ball.
That's right. Without the period in front of it. That's this one, three. This is bowling. But the ball is too big in bowling.
Okay.
Just 300 without the decimal point.
Career wins for a pitcher?
Okay, any pitcher who wins 300 games in a career, I think they're all in the Hall of Fame, you know, who have won that.
Stutton is not.
Has he won 300?
Yeah, 324.
He watched him.
Okay, he'll be there, though.
Right.
He'll be there. 90 feet.
Okay.
Distance from one base to the other, 90 feet. What's fascinating to think about is how different the game of baseball would be if it were 89 feet or 91 feet. You know, we've all been at ball games and the number of close plays at first base where it's just being. Imagine how different it would be if it were. Talk about providence and serendipity.
Yeah.
The field was laid out, 90 was the magic number. It must be in Revelation somewhere. 61.
Maris is home runs.
Okay, most number of home runs in a season that anyone has hit, Roger Maris, in what year?
61.
And everyone's wondering if Ken Griffey is going to do it, you know, in 61 or 62 this year. The intense interest that people have about this number and whether Ken Griffey will surpass it is bizarre in some people's minds and perfectly understandable to the rest of us. This is a little tougher, 190.
Hack Wilson, RBIs.
Okay, that's the all-time record for the number of runs batted in one season. 190, it was Hack Wilson. I bet you know the year, too.
1930, I think.
Got it.
I'm sitting in the right place.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Never
heard of a sports question with him.
60 feet, 6 inches.
Pitchers,
rubber to actually the back of home plate. The back corner of home plate. Now, imagine if it were 62 feet or 59 feet. Again, the game of baseball would be radically different.
For some of you.
Twenty.
Pitching wins.
Okay. Sort of the hallmark of an excellent pitching season if you win 20 games in 1 year. To win 300 games in a career, or 324, as Don Sutton has done, means winning 20 games a year, 15 years in a row. And there aren't many pitchers in any 1 year who win 20. And that shows the quality of those who get enshrined in the Hall of Fame. 56.
DiMaggio.
All right. That's the number of consecutive games that Joe DiMaggio got a hit in. And it's never been, nobody's even gotten beyond about 44, I think. And what year was that?
It was Rose, but
58?
No, but when DiMaggio did this. 1941. Okay, here's a couple that are related, but a little bit different. 301.
Lowest batting average to win the batting title.
Okay.
The
lowest batting average ever to win the title. And in fact, it was 300 and a half, but they rounded up to 301. And who did that?
Sterling-wise?
No. Carl Yastrzemski did that. 1968 for the Red Sox.
With a triple crown here?
I think that was 67.
Okay. Yeah, it was.
And
Bob Gibson.
1.12.
Yeah,
okay. You should come up here and just do this.
He has another next one. Yeah. Somebody else. Come on.
1.12 is the earned run average of Bob Gibson in 1968. This was the year when, because the pitchers were so good and the batters were so outperformed by the pitchers, that one of the rare dimensional changes in the history of baseball happened. They lowered the pitching mound from 15 inches to 10 inches to try to level the playing field, as they say, a little bit, not quite level, so that there was a better balance. And this is one of the things about baseball. It's one of those sports, all sports should be like this, and maybe they all are, where there's great effort to try to balance things between offense and defense so that teams can't just automatically win because of some factor that favors one side or the other.
The mound goes up.
Yeah. Goes up?
Yes.
I hadn't even heard that.
I think so.
Going up to...
I don't know how far. I think it goes back up.
Okay. Cool. And 215.
Longest game?
No, this is .215. I heard it.
Mendoza.
Okay. It's called the Mendoza line. Can you explain that?
Futility.
Mario Mendoza was a weak-hitting infielder whose lifetime batting average was .215. And for some reason, Major League Baseball players have chosen that as the line of futility as opposed to batting .300, which makes for a great season. .215 as a lifetime is pretty bad. And they talk about batters not even being able to hit their own weight, you know. And you know, think of a person like Gorman Thomas, whom some of you remember, big husky guy who played for Milwaukee and Seattle. And his lifetime batting average was .225. He couldn't hit his own weight. I couldn't either when I was 135. Got my own Mendoza line. And then a few uniform numbers. Number three.
Babe Ruth's
uniform number. Number seven.
Mantle.
Mickey Mantle. See him?
No, Carl Farrell.
Carl Farrell. Okay.
It's okay.
And 42.
And Jackie Robinson.
Jackie Robinson. Yeah. Look, stand up, Michael.
Yeah.
Look at that. What a guy. I saw him wearing that yesterday and said, I didn't know you loved baseball. It was 50 years ago this year that Jackie Robinson became the first black player in the 20th century to play in the major leagues. So there's a lot of Jackie Robinson stuff this year. And Major League Baseball decided to permanently retire number 42, so no player in the future of baseball can wear number 42, except Michael Pellett, of course. But I thought it was wonderful of him to be honoring Jackie Robinson in this year by wearing that number.
But current players that have it can still wear it.
That's right. It's being grandfathered out. Those who have their number already can keep, have number 42, can keep it. One player, this is another trivia question just for fun, one player had his birthday on his uniform. Anybody know who that is?
Number 11, something like that?
Well, it was Lee May of the White Sox and
Kansas City,
and he chose his numbers to be 17. So it said May 17 on the back of his jersey. That was his birthday, as well as sitting to my.
Yeah.
Here's a trivia question for you.
Okay.
There's only one player that currently has been on active American League roster for the entire time that Cal Ripken's streak has been going on, that could have even approached his streak by being on an active roster, position player.
On one team?
No, not on one team.
Okay, but somebody who's been playing
the entire time since Ripken's streak has been going on is a position player and has been on an active roster. Only one player in American League has even been on an active roster that much of the time.
Okay, can somebody have a good guess on that?
Wade Boggs.
Wade Boggs. Okay.
And Wade says, I play 155 games a year and I'm exhausted. I don't know how Ripken does it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well this is just to sort of have you help me demonstrate how the historical stuff of baseball is part of the what we bear around with us, and it allows those who follow the game to be constantly making comparisons between now and then, constantly recognizing what players are surpassing the skills of other players. And when you have all of this kind of numerical data, this is one of the things that, about that we talk about, statistics. Why is baseball more fascinating to some people than other sports? Virtually everything that happens in baseball is measurable. On offense and defense, every play, every pitch thrown, all these things are measured. And unlike football, where, you know, how do you measure the number of times that the right guard knocks down the left guard on the other side? You know, you don't measure all those things. But in baseball, every time a player touches the ball or hits it with the bat, we measure it. And for some people, this gives that fascination with being able to make tangible, to quantify everything, which helps us make sense out of things that are difficult otherwise. I'm a teacher of literature and writing, and there's wonderful writing about baseball, unlike most sports. You know, there isn't a great body of great American novels about wrestling or hockey, you know, but there is about baseball. And some of our best writers have taken it up. And I've listed here some novels down through this one. These are some of the novels that I've used in the course, and that if you'd like to read fiction about baseball, these are wonderful novels. There are lots that aren't wonderful, of course. There's a book published about baseball every day of the year. We got a review of baseball books published in the previous year, 400 books. And that continues. It's probably 500 by now. So just imagine that there's a baseball book published every day of the year. Some of them are juvenile books, or, you know, My Life in Baseball by, you know, some millionaire utility infielder writing about his life, but people buy it, so they get published. But these are wonderful novels, and you'll recognize some of these titles. And some of them have been made into movies. One of the fun things is that in recent years, Hollywood has taken up the making of good baseball movies. Now, there have been bad baseball movies, you know, made for years. Ronald Reagan starred in one of them. But they haven't all been bad, but recently they've gotten to be very good. Some of you have seen Bull Durham and A League of Their Own, and The Natural, and Field of Dreams. Wonderful movies. Field of Dreams is based on this novel called Shoeless Joe. The Natural is a dark, heavy, gloomy novel. I like the movie much better because something different happens at the end. It's a much more satisfying movie than it is a book, which is rare for an English professor to say. But, and I think two of the very best baseball books ever written are The Southpaw and Bang the Drum Slowly. There's been a good movie made out of Bang the Drum Slowly, one of Robert De Niro's first good roles in a movie. He's excellent in that. But if you want some good titles of books to buy, if you want to read novels, there's a good start. I have the class buy 9 books every year because, of course, there are 9 players in a baseball lineup.
9 innings in a game.
9 innings in a game. I limit the class size to 25 because that's the major league roster limit. We try to make this work as well as possible. One of the fascinating things, and again, the course is not just a course, you know, where we chew and spit and scratch and talk about the we do want to examine American culture. So one of the things that has taught me a lot about American culture, as it does to most of us, when you read a novel and then see the Hollywood movie it's made of it, and ask yourself, why did they make this change? Why did they do that? For instance, and I hope this doesn't give too much away, when Malamud wrote The Natural, which was his first novel, 1953, I think, the hero strikes out at the end. Mm-hmm. In the Hollywood movie, of course, he hits a home run. Mm-hmm. And everybody leaves the theater feeling great. You read the book, and it's just terrible. And, you know, this tells us a lot about us as a culture. You know, what is it that we want in our entertainment as opposed to what we're willing to have in our literature? Another thing I've done is to get the movies of the World Series. You know, every year, the Major League Baseball puts out a 40-minute version of, a condensed version of the World Series the previous fall. And these are shown at father and son banquets and sports banquets, you know, all winter long until the bright half of the year begins again on opening day. And what I do is take one of these from the 1940s and one from the 1950s and one from the 60s, one from the 70s, and it's amazing the changes in these films, in the music, in what they focus on. You know, back in the 40s and 50s, some of you have seen these. You know, the beginning of these black and white films, the camera zeroes in on, here's Happy Chandler, commissioner of baseball. Here's Ford Frick, president of the American, of the National League, and Mrs. Frick. The first 5 minutes of the film are taken up with all of these, all this stuff about the administration of baseball before they even get at the games. Now there's jazz music and choreograph and everything, and it's much more fun to watch. But this is an interesting way to look at the way in which the culture changes over the decades. And then, and in addition to having the class read about half a dozen novels, most of which raise lots of important questions about maturation, about fanaticism with sport, simply about growing up in America, and ethical questions. Almost all the books and many of the movies have something to do with the Black Sox scandal. Mm-hmm. 1919, the Chicago White Sox team was accused of gambling and intentionally losing games to the Cincinnati Reds and losing the World Series. And there's a wonderful movie called Eight Men Out, which addresses that issue. And the issue of fixing sports decisions comes into half the movies and half the books. So there's a great deal of interest in the whole ethics of sport. And the reason we have a commissioner, we used to have a commissioner in baseball. The reason the commissioner system started in 1920 with Kennesaw Mountain Landis, the only commissioner named after a mountain. It was because of the sense of importance that people felt that baseball had for America. And if gambling interests took over and you couldn't trust the integrity of the players, that America would be deeply damaged. And therefore we had to have a commissioner with a firm control over the righteousness of baseball so that things wouldn't go bad. Language is a wonderful thing. Baseball has worked itself into our everyday language. Let's hear a few of the cliches. Some of the
out in left field.
Out in left field.
Can't get to first base.
Can't get to first base.
Strikeout.
To strike out. Yep. Have two strikes against you. Out of the ballpark.
Three strikes, you're out.
Three strikes and you're out. Yep. Baseball, you know, if we wanted to take the time, we could fill this board with the baseball metaphors that have become common knowledge. The meaning of them has become common. One of my favorites was at the Democratic National Convention in 19... Karen, help me out with this. It was when it was in Texas, and the Governor Richardson of Texas,
Ann Richards,
she was giving a keynote address, I think, as the Democrats were nominating someone to run against George Bush. And the line she said was, in talking about George Bush's wealth and privilege, she said, "George Bush was born on third base, and he thinks he hit a triple." So language is another area that I find fascinating to examine with my students to see, you know, why it is that this sport has given us so much of it. We talked a little bit about statistics, and of course there's a ton of things you can say about statistics. There's a math professor at St. Olaf, one of my colleagues, who gave a presentation one time on the strategy of a manager in deciding whether to sacrifice a runner to second base. If you get the first batter on, what are the odds of getting that runner home if you have the next batter sacrifice him in order to get him to second base? And if there are two outs, are the odds better or worse, and so forth. Fascinating formula that he had that filled the whole board just to explain. And of course, the result is that most managers, you know, have always been making the wrong decisions. Psychology is one of the most fascinating aspects of all of this for me. I've always tried to understand myself. You know, why a grown man like myself cares so much about baseball, cares so much about the Twins, and why other people I know who are otherwise sane and well-balanced, you know, have the same passionate interest. And then why we as a state or a city, when our team is winning and we're in the World Series, the whole place just goes crazy. And Karen and I danced in the streets when the Twins won the 1987 World Series. And you know, the next morning we wake up and ask ourselves, why did we do that? Especially Karen.
Yeah, right.
We celebrated not with the dancing, but equally hard in 91 when we beat the Braves. But I'd like your ideas about why this is. You know, why we have such a passionate attachment to a team. Now think of it. I care about the Minnesota Twins because they're the team closest at hand. When I was a child and first learned about baseball with the help of my father, we lived in a suburb of Chicago. So it was the Cubs. And my hero became Andy Pafko, who played, he was the franchise player for the Cubs. And the darkest day of my childhood was June 15th, 1951, when hours before the trading deadline, the Cubs traded Andy Pafko to the Brooklyn Dodgers. And everyone said, well, that sews up the pennant for Brooklyn.
Yeah.
They have a powerful team already, and were way ahead in the pennant race anyway. Then they got Chicago's best player, and it was a no-brainer. Well, that was the year when Bobby Thompson hit his famous home run. I'm sorry. And this home run is the most famous home run in baseball history, and it won the pennant for the much-hated Giants.
The Giants
win the pennant. See, he can remember what the announcer was saying on that day. But I'm now, as we have moved around, I've changed my loyalties. I later became a Milwaukee Braves fan, partly because Andy Pafko by that time had been traded to the Braves. But we lived in Madison, Wisconsin, so we were close by as well. And then Andy Pafko retired, and then we moved to Minneapolis eventually, so I became a Twins fan. So I'm, you know, I've shifted my loyalties around. But there are some people, some of them even in this room, even as we speak, who have never forgiven Walter O'Malley for moving the Brooklyn Dodgers to another coast. Always a Brooklyn Dodger fan, even though the team hasn't even existed for 40 years. Go figure. It's true. How many of you here are loyal to a particular team, the baseball team? Okay. Is it the team in your town or close by or your state?
Yeah.
Anybody who, there's one who's not. Explain.
Oh, no, it is.
Oh, it is. Okay. Well, Warren, you might as well explain. You know, Warren grew up in Brooklyn, and the Dodgers were life to many people in Brooklyn.
It was a part of the culture.
Yeah.
Really, it was a part of the culture. When I walked down the block, and when I came, when I heard cheering, I could enter anyone's porch and hear what was going on and have a conversation. You know, you could talk to anybody in Brooklyn about the Dodgers. In fact, I told you, my mother died last September, and the day before her death, I had a book on the Dodgers. I was reading the chapter, and I read the chapter to my mother the day before her death. And she was all excited about the Dodgers, you know.
Yep.
She remembered the names and all of
that. Yeah, right.
So
it was grow up not only with the game, but with the team.
Yeah.
And nowadays, baseball has changed dramatically. It used to be that the owners of a team virtually owned the players. A player couldn't simply sell his services to another team. You were owned by the team until the management decided to trade you away. So players stayed with one team for a long time. And in fact, this was the reason for the great Black Sox scandal in 1919. Charles Comiskey, who owned the White Sox, was such a skinflint that they underpaid his players, and the gamblers offered them, you know, half a year's salary to lose a game by not quite being able to catch that fly ball. And it seemed like a good deal to them. And Shoeless Joe Jackson, who is one of the characters in this book, you know, was one of the greatest players in, greatest hitters in baseball, played for that team, swears that he never intended to and didn't actually throw the game, didn't lose the game, but he was banished from baseball. He was the one of whom they said, Shoeless Joe Jackson's glove is where triples go to die. He was such a good fielder and a fantastic hitter, but he was banished from baseball, and currently one of the interests of baseball fans is to get him admitted to the Hall of Fame because he was of that quality. But because he was banned from baseball at one time, he has been ineligible under the baseball rules. Well, Ed, think and talk amongst yourselves from time to time about this fanaticism, which is what the word means, to be a fan, is to be a fanatic, to care intensely and sometimes unreasonably about a team or about a player and about the game, and give so much attention to it. Because I think it tells us a great deal about who we are as individuals, our need for identification with somebody who is excellent, somebody who is doing something very, very well. Some people attach their fanaticism to rock stars or movie actors or to
English professors. One of the things you haven't touched on, I think, is how it harks back to childhood and what you've done with your family and what you've done with your father.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things you happen to think about, and it hasn't come up here, but in my case, I'm not a baseball fan in the way that David is. I enjoy it when I go. And I can get intrigued with certain kinds of players, but what I love about it is how it reminds me of how I was with my father, who wanted to play in the majors when he was young in South Dakota and did play in those farm teams. And us kids just always went with him. And mostly we ran around and ate popcorn and played with our friends. But it always kind of surprises David that I know the names of the players from back then because of how my dad talked about it and what a big deal it was. And so I don't have the fanaticism, but I have part of the myth and the memory of what it was like to be family in that context.
It's still fascinating to think about why it should be baseball with so many families rather than fishing, although many families, you know, share that kind of a legacy, or bowling. But baseball seems to have captured the imagination of a very high percentage of American families.
Well, in the old days of politics, one of the really funny things was that they would play baseball on donkeys. And
Democrats, anyway.
Democrats. Well, and, you know, it was hilarious, but it was part of that problem.
When I teach my baseball course, I tell my students that the first time I ever came to Holden Village, we drove across the country as a family, and 40 miles west of Pierre, South Dakota, in the midst of absolutely nothing, and 5 miles from the nearest little hamlet, on Highway 34, there is suddenly light standards and a baseball park with a press box and bleachers and a backstop and the whole bit, and lights out there. There's nothing nearby, and this is a field where Karen said, well, Dad used to play baseball there during campaigns. Then we get to Holden. What has happened with when the miners first arrived in this valley and didn't have the tailings? The only flat spot within 30 miles of here, they make a baseball park out of it. And last week we went down to celebrate Midsummer Nights and had a village baseball game there.
And pieces of board of the bleachers are still on the side.
Yeah. As you walk the path down the first baseline and out toward Hart Lake and Holden Lake, the bleachers are crumbling there in the brush. You can still see them there. And there's a picture up at the Portal Museum of those bleachers filled with people watching a baseball game being played out there. Anyway, the business of being so the psychology of being so attached to a game, so excited about, you know, a bunch of millionaires in flannels out there playing a game is really fascinating to me. Yeah.
I once heard a history professor say that we should be happy that it fulfills a need and is a substitute for war, which they had in earlier times.
Mm-hmm. That's one theory about athletic competition, because it allows us to exert ourselves at a high physical level and skill and vanquish an opponent without killing them, usually. And the sport, you know, fulfills that human need. Another theory is by Michael Novak, a prominent Roman Catholic theologian who's written a book called The Joy of Sports, which many of you would love. He points out that, or his claim is that human beings are not just Homo sapiens, that is the creatures who think, but Homo ludens, the creatures who play. And that we all have an intense need to play. We work all week, and millions of people live for the weekend when they can go out and play. And if many of us had our choice, we would play as much as we can rather than work. And look at children before they become over-civilized by their adults in their lives. Constantly playing, running all over. All day long, it's play for a child. And that finally gets worked out of our systems as we mature. But there's much to be thought about in terms of the human impulse to do games and sports and athletics. In part to keep from fighting, in part to satisfy basic needs. And it's Novak is very persuasive in talking about sport, not just baseball, but a few other sports as well.
David, psychologically, you know, the baseball, you know, is 152 games. And all the factory workers had the games on in the factories. And this was a different game every day.
Yeah.
So you can chat about the game every day, you know. Yeah. And I think that's what kept a lot of factory workers going during the year.
Sure.
Because the game, and baseball is a game you can listen to on the radio. You don't have to have it on television. It's a horrible game on television. It's a better game on the way radio if you know the game.
Yeah, that's right.
So the factory workers could all listen to the ball games all the time.
Yeah, that's right. It is one of those things that the factory workers can listen to a game. They probably wouldn't have chosen poetry as the thing that they would do and talk about the next day, but somehow baseball doesn't. I heard Michael, who's next door, and he's probably talking about baseball too, as he has in his lecture series, to say that he is during half of the year, his day starts when he gets up, goes out and gets the paper, gets a pot of coffee and sits there in his underwear at the kitchen table reading the box scores.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, don't quote me on this in the wrong places, but I spend more time reading the box scores than reading poetry. And I ask myself again, you know, why? how many of you spend more time reading the sports pages or the box scores than you do reading reviews of opera and ballet? Now, Michael Novak's point is that, you know, this is a sign. You know, we think of high culture as being the symphony and the opera and the ballet, but where do we put our bodies? You know, basically, collectively as a nation, many of us as individuals, even those of us who love ballet or the symphony, we spend more time looking at the box scores or talking about baseball.
One of the interesting things, David, is that it's not just identifying with a winner or hero worship, but I come from northern Minnesota where people are fanatics about hockey.
Yeah.
And really could care less about the Twins.
Yeah.
But in the last 5 years, we've had the Northern League in the upper Midwest. And what's interesting to me is that here's a league where every year the players turn over, except for maybe two or three on a team. The players completely turn over. The people who go to the games don't even bother to really get to know the players' names.
Yeah.
Could care less who the players are. And in fact, in my city, they don't care if they win or lose. And in fact, in the last 5 years, they've been at the bottom of the heap in the last four out of five times last year they made the playoffs. But they play good baseball, and people go to these games. And they don't go to the games because of the players, and these players aren't making any money.
Yeah.
They go to the game because of the game.
That's right.
And they go to the game because they can hear the bat crack, they can smell the popcorn, they can hear the players talking in the dugout. But they actually go because of the game. And that kind of surprised me.
Yeah. Well, that's part of what we talk about when we get into things like aesthetics. It's a beautiful game. And all of us who were frustrated by the strike and discouraged about that, we've got to remember that it was several hundred millionaires we were mad at. The owners and the Major League Baseball players who are making $1 million a year. Baseball was being played and enjoyed all over the land while those guys were on strike and fighting over their salaries. It's a beautiful game. It's a game that most of us can imagine doing and actually can do to a certain degree. I couldn't sink a basket against the Bulls or hope to gain 2 yards against the Green Bay Packer front line. But I can imagine hitting a bloop single at least, maybe not off Randy Johnson. But it's a game where all body types, different kind of skills are rewarded, and it's a game that many of us, boys and girls, play at some stage of our lives and enjoy. And it's a game that many of us continue to enjoy because of the beauty of a good baseball field, crack of the bat, a baseball. I think this is one of the finest inventions of humankind.
The only person you'll ever meet who bought his car because they advertised a baseball.
Gave me a free baseball cap.
They knew they had a sucker.
This is the risk of being in Holden, all of your weaknesses are exposed. We fuss a lot about the economics of baseball and other sports because salaries are crazy. I can't understand why the owners are paying these things. The fights we have over stadiums. Economics is a huge thing with baseball and other professional sports. The amount of money that we as individuals, $10-$12 a ticket, or cities, $500 million for a stadium, are able and willing to spend for this game, this child's game that adults are playing. And we do it. And that's another fascinating thing about our economic priorities. Sociology is fascinating to me, the way in which baseball has helped various minority groups move into mainstream American life. Jackie Robinson, whom we're celebrating and remembering this year, it took great courage for him and for Branch Rickey, who brought him into the major leagues at a time when it was white folks only. And it's a fascinating story that I hope you've been reading a little bit about. One of my favorite little episodes happened when the Dodgers, the Brooklyn Dodgers, with Jackie Robinson playing with them, were playing in the only southern state that had a major league team, Missouri. And the Dodgers went to play the Cardinals. And the day before the first road trip here, when the Dodgers were going to play the Cardinals, the Cardinal players announced that they would refuse to take the field against the Dodgers because a black man was playing for them. Ford Frick, the president of the National League, bless his soul, sent a message to the St. Louis Cardinal team and said, if you don't take the field to play against the Brooklyn Dodgers tomorrow, none of you will ever play another Major League Baseball game the rest of your life. and he had the authority to do that. The Cardinals played, and baseball became well integrated long before the Civil Rights Act of the early 60s. I mean, in some ways, sport can, you know, push or pull the rest of society along, and baseball is one way in which this has happened. Oh my, we don't have much time. Are there any good questions you want to ask?
I wanted to ask where the term Grand Slam came from, because I play bridge, and it's a common term in bridge, and mm-hmm. I suspect bridge might have been going on longer than baseball, but I don't know.
Anybody answer that? Where Grand Slam came from? It wasn't Denny's. They've adopted that from baseball. I mean, it may have come from...
I bet it's a card term.
Cards. I don't know the answer to this one. I know where doubleheader came from.
How about a can of corn?
Okay.
A can of corn to the right fielder.
Yeah, an easy fly ball. It's called a can of corn. Anybody know what that...
I know. Mm-hmm. I think it had to do with times when they used to stock small grocery stores on the shelves, and cans were way up high, and they used to just knock them in.
They had, the grocers had these long sticks, and they'd nudge a can, and it would just fall right into your hands, just like an easy fly ball. That's where that one's from. Doubleheader is from railroading. Chuck Anderson isn't here to verify this, but he will, if you ask him. A lot of, yeah.
I was going to say another question. Why do you suppose, it's hard to know, baseball is the only sport where the manager wears the uniform of the players. What is the significance behind that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why do the managers wear the uniform with a much larger waistline, usually,
right.
than the players do?
Sometimes. Bert Sutton never did. Okay. Connie Mack called him.
Connie Mack didn't?
No.
Some of them actually play.
Yeah,
that's right.
Managers. And they all, and they do enter the field.
That's right. There are, you know, baseball has its own traditions, some of them good and some of them bad. You know, the fights are terrible. You go out there to protect your teammates. Ridiculous. But one of them is the uniform, and Connie Mack never left the dugout. He always wore his civvies and never left the dugout to go out to the pitcher's mound, but dressed in a suit.
And Bert Schotten didn't either.
Bert Schotten?
No.
Did he stay in the dugout?
Yeah, he wore a suit.
Yeah. And there were some playing managers, like Lou Boudreau, who for Cleveland, you know, managed and was a starting infielder. And because the manager goes out to kick dirt at the umpire, on occasion, you know, you have to be in uniform to be out on the playing field. But, you know, it's an interesting question. Yeah.
That story that I got from reading Shoeless Joe that I've always thought was kind of delightful was that whole story about Moonlight Graham.
Mm-hmm.
You know, played, had the shortest major league career in history, one inning.
Yeah. That's right. And it's true. You know, I've looked it up in my baseball encyclopedia. Aaron gives me bad time that the largest book in my, in my library is the baseball encyclopedia. Yeah. In fact, a lot of these novels, a lot of the details are taken from actual baseball history, even though it's not immediately evident. There are footnotes. The last thing I wanted to say, well, you had a few.
I was just going to ask if women respond to different aspects of the game than men. The reason I say that is because we have a player on the Mariners team who, a couple years ago, he's not as well known as Griffey, of course, but one of the plays he made at the very end in the playoffs really kind of caused the game, the team to lose the game.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards he cried. It was really an upsetting scene, and I think the women in Seattle really reacted to that.
That's Joey Cora.
Joey Cora. Yeah.
They reacted badly.
Oh, they love him.
Oh, they love him.
Because he showed a humanness that shown their
own. Yeah.
It was after they lost to Cleveland in the American League playoffs, and Alex Rodriguez put his arm around him, the rookie, consoling him, and Cora was in tears in the dugout after they lost the playoff.
Yeah. Well, you wish that it would happen more. I mean, again, this is part of the macho tradition of baseball, is that you don't show your emotions. You hit that home run and you just run around there grimly, and you don't smile about it until later, unless it's the game-winning home run in the World Series. Then you...
Then you leap around the base paths.
And you know you won't face the same pitcher again.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good point. There's a lot behind that.
No.
The one I skipped over unintentionally was religion, and we won't have time to do this now. I mean, the bell's going to ring for Vespers shortly, but you know, it's something that we can all think about and you can talk about with your friends. It's scary to realize how many similarities there are between our devotion to professional sports and religion. You know, there are the sacred places, there are the temples, you know, there are the officiants, there are the holy books, there are the liturgies, the rituals, and you know, we could fill this board again with all the aspects of sport that look just like religion. And of course, one definition of religion is it's the most important thing in one's life that you give your devotion to. And when you think about what half the nation is doing at noon on Sunday during the dark half of the year, watching a professional football game, and you know, these temples that we build to our sports, and you know, there's a church year, you know, there's opening day, there's the All-Star game, there's the playoffs, there's the World Series, and it's almost like the liturgical church calendar. You're just all sorts of similarities and kind of devotedness that we have to sports that resemble in a very scary way our devotion to more important gods. But for many people, sport has become a kind of natural or national religion, and it requires some careful self-examination by all of us to ask why we care this much. But ultimately, it's a game. It's something that can be played and enjoyed by people of all ages, remembered, discussed, it's in the factory, studied, like many other aspects of life. But in our culture and in a few other nations where baseball has also taken a grip, this particular game has been predominant. And one of the things, we also didn't get into metaphysics, but one of the things to think about is, what is it about this game that makes you so interested in it, if you are? Is it the balance of offense and defense? You know, it's one of these games where when you're on offense, you can't touch the ball. You're not allowed to touch the ball if you're the team that's on offense. And instead of trying to penetrate the opposition's territory and sort of capture their land, the end zone or whatever, the object is to go for a stroll and come home. The fields are not all identical, and there's all this wide open space, and it's the individuality of each player being isolated from all the other players, and everything that they do brilliantly or badly is isolated there for all of us to see, and a lot of factors about the game that make it fascinating to us. I haven't heard the bell, but I see people walking over there, and I think it's 7:25 and time for us to end. So, game's over.